On this week's show, Experiencing Change with Charlie Dunn from DPR Construction.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started The Contech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in Contech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's Contech Crew time.
All right, Nathan Wood, it feels like I just saw you and had a little fun, didn't we?
We did, yeah. Denver was a lot of fun. Although Thanksgiving was felt like it went by very fast as well. But it was good to be together down in Denver.
It's like 2 weeks ago, but you know, the experience just sticks with you. And it wouldn't be any fun if we didn't have Charlie Dunn with us. Charlie, how you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good. Yeah, I've learned to take that call when Jeff has something and he's like, hey, what do you think? Should we try this? And we do, and it's cool.
Are we gonna change that here? Hold my beer. It's gonna be here. Hold my microphone. Let me see what happens. And you know, it doesn't turn out so bad, I don't think. You know, we don't win every time, but you know, we've got a good streak going right now.
Yeah, so pretty simple basics. Good people, good challenge, and see what happens.
Yeah, what we put together. Plenty of coffee, plenty of crazy ideas, a cool venue, and a bunch of really cool people. And that turns into a pretty cool experience.
Gotta include Legos. You don't have to, but it does help.
You know, Legos, ping pong balls, who knows?
Chicago, we did the numbers game and drop the boxes. I think Legos or the boxes, one of those two, you got to have. The rest we can fill in and out. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody's confused now. We'll take you out of confusion in just a minute.
If you know, you know. If you don't, find us, we'll be somewhere.
Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the Contech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more.
All right, so for everybody listening in, Charlie Dunn, those that don't know you, kind of give your background real quick, get us up to speed how you got here, and we will talk a little bit about those crazy experiences you're referring to.
Yes, so I like to start by what I really focus on, like the problems that matter to me, and the big one for construction is production. And two thoughts. One, you're not going to move the needle on production until you design for production. And then the second one, you're not going to have a chance to really accelerate production until you eliminate rework. And often we skip past those two and we're fighting. Anyway, and I have a chance to work on this with DPR. I've been here 8 years now. I have opportunity to touch a lot of different projects early, in the middle when it's a fight, toward the end the closeout, pursuits, good owners. So I've been thankful for that opportunity. And then, you know, met you guys through trying to bring some of what we've learned, make it clear, create the opportunity for people to feel it and want this change. With some of these events, they were initially focused on field training and learned that, hey, what the guys in the field like it, everybody else is going to like it. So yeah, I'm grateful to work in an industry where there's a chance to have tremendous impact every day.
Yeah, it really makes some change. And I want to talk a little bit about that. Like you hit it there. If the field likes it, everybody likes it. I think that's a tech thing, but actually really it's a production, it's a change, it's an experience thing. If the field, the people putting in the work, managing the work, like it, it's going to make a difference, right? Because then it's a positive change. So go back, you know, you have some experience in past areas with manufacturing, a little bit in nuclear. What are some of those ideas you brought from there that connected you with DPR and found this bigger problem that you're focused on now?
Well, one thread from early in my career is just how important the people fundamentals are. trust, you know, now it's been documented and refined a little bit with this, you know, science around psychological safety. But you know, my real business education came with an operation consulting firm that focused on the relationships. And then at the same time, also focused on not being a consulting partner, but being a get in the trenches and do work with your partner, and come in and make sure, you know, you're there through to the success, not just handing off a manual and the good luck. So that I'm always grateful for. Yeah. And then the time in manufacturing, just, you know, scientific method, pay attention to data, document processes, make small incremental changes and prove the value of what you're doing. We struggle with that one in construction big time still. Bumped into construction projects in Vegas during the boom and learned Primavera there. And that was kind of like my path over to, you know, construction with a little detour, 5 years in the nuclear industry. And the nuclear industry, surprisingly enough, that was one of the places I really saw lean applied successfully. And I was not expecting it. I'd learned lean in manufacturing, but some lean Six Sigma processes to get ready for outage management, which is, I still go back to rafting, and that's something we haven't done together yet, right? So we've in Austin, we've done a morning lake swim. I know Nathan, you've done some skiing, but whitewater rafting, some tremendous analogies to what we do with projects. And anyway, nuclear, that's what it felt like. Like, man, we are in the middle of these rapids trying to survive. But in the middle of that, and this is really where I think that field focus came in. And I first learned, like, okay, the guys at the point of the work and the people in the corner office downtown want simplicity. They don't want the noise. They don't want the complicated views. They don't want the dashboards that you'd crash if you were trying to use that as a dashboard and drive by it because it's too dense, right? They need simple, actionable. What does this mean and what do I do about it? And I really learned that at the time in nuclear before then, December 2017, joining DPR.
So Charlie, I'm sure you haven't listened, it may not even come out yet, but Aaron and I in our end of year episode actually had conflicting outlooks on the industry. His was to go fast because everything's going fast. And mine, I think I was probably channeling my inner Charlie when I said, you know, go slow to go fast. And I think it was you actually told me a story from the nuclear industry about a project of just the value of waiting to plan before you go. That is such a misconception. I guess, can you double down on that a little bit? Because I think that's a really important point for this industry that always wants to go, go, go. But really, that's part of the problem, right?
Yes. Taking that time to plan. And maybe the story was this one. I remember we were held up. So often I was in the nuclear major projects group. So we'd be doing something significant that was beyond what the plant normally did in the kind of their maintenance period during the outage. So we would have windows where we could start our work, and sometimes they would hit a snag and our window would start later. So this happened to us and we were given another day, and that doesn't sound like much, but in an outage, quite literally in 12 hours, we'd do the same volume of work that I normally see in general construction in like 3 to 6 months. Like that's how compressed the work is. And in that day, we were able to assess conditions, do some additional planning, and we shaved another 35% off of some work that we thought we'd optimized as best we could. So yeah, this idea of planning to plan, having a roadmap for what you need to do, and then planning, and then a very small amount of doing. Often we jump right into the doing, and recently I heard it actually after being with you guys in Denver, I went and visited a job site and a superintendent there. She said, yeah, this project, some of these areas are kind of build design. So we're building it and the design is catching up. And often we end up the same thing. We're going so fast. It's like build schedule. Like what did we do? And what's the sequence? And what that robs us of is any chance to get better. Like to do real continuous improvement, to set a baseline. Here's how we plan to perform and then measure against that baseline. And that's really what we're able to do in nuclear, because we had to, because we're regulated, we had to have that baseline of data for what was done. And then we could measure against that in future efforts doing similar type projects.
And that's where I think, yeah, nuclear is probably a better example than maybe, because the argument against manufacturing is that you have that repeatability. You have that, you know, you're going to make however many thousands and millions of widgets versus construction. You know, virtually every project is a prototype. But your nuclear example, yeah, every project, every situation is unique. And I think your approach is the right one that fits for construction. So there's a lot of nuance in that, and that there's a lot of lean things from manufacturing we can apply, but there's a lot that's like, well, that's based on them.
Yeah, we're too quick to give ourselves a pass. And you guys have experienced that. Like, a lot of what we're after in these workshops is we don't change the conditions. We change the strategy and we get a different outcome. Like in construction, far too often we, you know, and normally sometimes if I'm, depending on who's in the room, I'll bring out my air violin and play us a sad song, right? Like, oh, the conditions are so hard. We can't do.
Well, it's
no,
me.
We can. It's just, will we or won't we? And so Olaf, executive for BMW, Nathan, what you just said about everything's a prototype, he said, and he used some French, no. What you're about to do for us, you've done concrete before. You've done structural steel before. You've done skin before. You've done MEP overhead before. All of this is repeatable when you look at it at the work step level. So don't tell me you're doing a prototype. And that work step, tact area, work package level of focus unleashes, and this is something I did learn in manufacturing, the manufacturing multiplier. If I'm going to do something hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of times, my motivation to get that thing dialed and efficient goes way up. So if we can recognize in construction, hey, I'm going to hang this board this way 3,000 times on this project. And this is a true story. I'm going to develop a cleat so a guy on a toe of his boot has a kicker and he can move that board as an individual rather than as two people. And that's just one example of once we identify, here's the work step that's got this manufacturing multiplier. Let's go optimize that work step. You'll unleash a lot of, you know, creative momentum to getting better.
Yeah. And that dovetails into another of your points. And this is the things that we've been doing in these exercises that really, you know, kind of, I love the aha moment and we get to see it a lot is, well, I'm too busy. I have to start working. And you show the value of taking time to plan. Because I think in our industry, we look at the time to plan as construction, as a waste, and as a completely separate process than the design and the bidding and sort of the estimating of what it's going to cost, right? They seem like two very separate things. And you're saying, no, there's value that we're going to continuously do this. So how do you break people of that problem? How do you get them to realize it?
Well, part of it, and this is in fairness, is it's a horrible experience. The current approach and some of the tools, and I'll use this language that planning is something that is done to people and not done with people. So it's fundamentally you shift that experience. And what are the key pieces to shifting that experience? Start with the model. Create time machines. Connect the schedule to the model, go into the future. Say, hey, this is what we say we're going to do. You'll always find problems. You'll come back to the present. You'll Dr. Strange that thing over and over on your wrist, and you'll negotiate with the future until you get what you want. Like, that's the power of the visual approach to planning. It also puts us in a better place where I talk about this concept of approximation error that it hit me when we were doing a visual production methodology and we were statusing daily on the model work and we'd set up rules of credit. Simple example, grade beams. 40% credit when you've excavated, 40% credit when you've set the rebar, 20% credit when you poured the concrete. We had 8 different people in a kind of a democratized way out there walking the work and statusing various scopes in this way. On the grade beam one, we had a 2-week duration activity to do grade beams from column lines 4 to column line 20. The scheduler had sent out a schedule update sheet and he got back the percent complete. And the guy said, that's 20% complete. The same person that told him 20% complete on the schedule update sheet, using the rules of credit from the discrete objects, said we're at 80% complete. What happened? approximation error. On that schedule update, all he had were these English words and what is your percent complete. In his mind, he thought, oh, well, we still have a lot of the pores to do. He wasn't thinking through what was the real work. There was an approximation error because all he was looking at was language that he approximated a little differently than other people. Once we go to the discrete object level, it's binary, it's done or not done, we establish rules of credit, now we're much more precise, we eliminate the approximation error. What's the problem with approximation error? It makes people not like each other. This makes people not trust each other. You say black, I say, you know, dark blue, and right, we get into these, we simply, so that's that fundamental of the value of the starting with the visual effort. People understand each other. You get rid of that, and then in the planning domain, approximation error, when it compounds, that's when people say, oh, we don't trust the schedule. So you have to create something that is collaborative. People have done it together. It's understood universally. And then there's trust. I say trust, belief, and buy-in. Everybody agrees, yes, this is an achievable plan.
Yeah. Well, and that's where it becomes so hard is the people, right? It's how many people are in that chain of dependencies of finding out at that level of detail, how much did you get done? How much did you plan? Because, you know, how much level is a GC supposed to go to at before they just put trust in or are feeding directly from that trade contractor what they're getting done? And that's always going to, like, this, in depending on the contract you're signing, that's going to be a contentious relationship of how much did you get done? Because this, as we always say, Jeff, you tell me how I measure, I'll tell you how I behave. And if it's all about, you know, like, why did he feel inclined to say only 20%? Like, obviously, like, he wasn't in a position where he was incentivized to say he got more done. Otherwise, he probably would have said 80%, right? So I think there's so much as in the context of even, you know, again, why you're doing what you're doing that drives the measurements, that drives ultimately the efficiency that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, there's definitely the subjective versus objective problem. And I used to say one of the reasons I don't like the what is your percent complete question is it depends. Has the guy had a smoke break recently? Has he been in a fight with his significant other? You know, is it like it's a, the state of mind comes in when you're doing a subjective versus an objective binary from data. You eliminate that. I do think, Nathan, you leaned into something there that's very important. And is that, again, that sense, does the schedule of the plan become a weapon? Right, is being used to try to force something versus is it a tool and a way to work better together? And weapons
are tools, technically.
Yes. Well, and I don't think I've riffed on this with you guys, but it's worth running in real quick. Like, we give people daggers and swords and shields and spears and trebuchets, and then we're surprised that a battle ensues. Now, notice, I didn't say machine guns or fighter planes, right? We're not that sophisticated yet, but we give people weapons and then we're surprised the fight breaks out. Like, we've got to start with different tools built for different reasons. But there's another thing in what you said, Nathan, about the amount of people and the amount of effort. And this is where, again, I see even well-intended attempts to make planning more collaborative and better. They start too late. It's too big a problem set. And it's simply kind of a kumbaya hope to manage chaos. And that's also not good. And so the exciting part about where we are with technology, coming back to Contech, right? What's the value of this tech is if I've got the model and I've done, you know, remembering that the production, you got to start with design for production and then you got to eliminate rework. So I've got a model and a design that's been built to be productive and I'm doing quality checks. So I'm not going to have rework. Now I can come into a planning session and we're no longer figuring out what the work is. We know it. We've also done a basic sequence because gravity is a thing, right? Who goes first, second, and third? There are some laws of physics that allow. And so now we start 60 to 80% complete with a plan based on what are we building and data for how fast we can go. And now we're making adjustments. We're making edits. It's very analogous to what happens when AI works well for us, where AI can get some of the initial heavy lift done, and then we're in there editing, refining. It's an exciting time to watch this, you know, come into the industry, because that's another thing I did not expect. Because I'd done my research. I knew DPR had a tremendous, you know, reputation with VDC, model-based workflows. But compared to nuclear, just how far behind we were, especially in the design process, like model organization, model quality, model standards. It's like we're on a lag as compared to some of the bigger EPC organizations, oil and gas, nuclear utility, but we're closing the gap on that lag and we're getting the basis we need earlier.
I think you're hitting on something though, because we had this discussion in the BIM coordination world that there's a difference between coordination and constructability. Because what you were just talking about is the sequencing, the gravity, the aspects that you don't often think about in that BIM world, but that is a totally separate, well, a separate, but in interactive kind of discussion with the coordination side, because the best way to coordinate, the most efficient way to coordinate, doesn't necessarily consider gravity and consider all these things. It's just designers getting together and coming up with the best answer, right? So there's like these,
right.
There's still this right. conflicting, like what is the best way to do it? Because you're not necessarily building it the way you, or designing it the way you build it. You're designing it the best way to design it, considering the way that you will be building it. There's some nuance in there. Do you agree?
Yes. Yeah. I had a chance to, and it was, this is a cool story connected to Lego, which is maybe why my mind goes here. I had a chance to present a paper at IGLC in France, mostly authored by Chad Arthur, who does what we call design management or early, you know, design planning at DPR. He's an architect. He's been teaching college courses. Brilliant, brilliant guy. But the focus of the research was construction informing design. Which is exactly what you just said, Nathan. How do you take that construction knowledge and in the iterative design process insert it so that how it's going to be built is accounted for in the design process? And this was a very clear aha for me in my path, and it's the language. If you go to LinkedIn, you see two things about me: project storyteller and production design. Production design, if you're in industrial engineering, this is a known thing. No manufacturer will ever develop a product, planning to go to market with it without knowing exactly how they will produce it during that early phase. When construction, we'll develop the product 100% and then throw it over the wall. Hey, go figure out how to build it. And the GC may rip it apart and put it back together again and then throw it over the wall to trade partners. And then they finally get it and they're like, okay, what are we really going to do here? Yeah, no. Construction informing design means get all that trade partner knowledge at the very start as you're, and then there's projects where this is happening. Where even in early validation phase, before we even start SDs, there's a tact level plan, zones and areas and speed, which drives us to how much prefab and other solutions we need so that we can maintain that tact for production. So we start SDs knowing what our constraints are, that the designers can be much more efficient. And what we find is that that early investment pays huge dividends, not just for construction, but also in these design iterations, where information comes in late out of sequence and puts us back in these do loops. But anyway, so back to the Lego thing. So I'm in France, presenting on this paper, and then I got to do Lego simulation, meet a guy from Denmark, Christian, whose company Exego has something called Tact Plan with a C, not with a K, that's more focused on line of balance, and I'm not going to geek out on that, but line of balance and location-based scheduling. He's trying to develop a friendlier, easier Bico. With Trimble sunsetting Bico. But anyway, he said, if you never come to Denmark, let me know. I'll put you in touch with the Lego Foundation. So I happened to figure out how to find myself in Denmark within the next 3 months. Got to tour the Lego house with Soren Holm, who designed the Lego house with Bjark Ingels. Dude, epic, epic. And then so much from that visit to the Lego house and how Lego does things that, one, validated what we've been trying to do. And then, two, gave me ideas for future iterations, stuff we haven't touched yet, like prototyping. Another thing in construction, don't tell a field guy you're going to try to do prototyping. Like, give them examples of prototyping and do it, right? Because a field guy, if it's not right the first time, they're like, okay, it's not going to work. Manufacturing prototyping, you know you're going to go through 4 to 7 iterations before you get it where you need it to be. And again, getting our smart builders comfortable with that as we work on offsite approaches. Anyways, Lego House, how do they do prototyping? They don't tell you they're going to teach you prototyping. They have two different car challenges, one to race down a hill and one to do a jump through a circle, and kids just go build. And then they go test and they come back and they make some changes, and they go test and they come back and they make some changes. And before long, they prototype themselves to a winning car on the speed or a car that meets the challenge of jumping through the hoop. But again, just a natural way, creating that challenge, play, test an idea, come back, refine.
Well, I think you're hitting on that culture shift, right? Because I think that we've had this mentality of we receive something over the fence, we know it's wrong, and it's our job to tell them what's wrong. But if we're invited over the fence early and to say, okay, you tell us what's right, that's a very different story, right? Like, I'm not ready to do that. I'm only ready to tell you what's wrong with yours. I'm not necessarily ready to tell you the best way for me.
Well, and here this is where it becomes both a technical and a social challenge, because we've had projects where the owner said, we're going to invest and we're going to do this. We're going to do early design assist. Then we bring trade partners in a market where traditionally they have not done early design assist, and they're sitting at the table, but they're used to the former relationship where we sit here until we're given something and then we figure it out. Rather than changing that relationship, we're asking you to speak up now. Like, we get it. Jacobs is a tremendous design firm. However, they don't have dirty boots the way you do. They don't work on the tools. So you need to tell them what they don't know about the field conditions. And so it's that, how do you change that social dynamic? And then there is a business dynamic as well. Trade partner, their best guys that keep them on point with their labor, with their production, they want those guys in the field. So the business dynamic is, how can we get those smart guys early out of the field long enough to make an impact? Because, well, that's the thing we've learned. You know, there's a lot of well-meaning PEs and PMs in the industry, but they haven't had that field time. And those are not the people you need in early design assist, because they also don't know the questions to ask. The gotchas don't have those scars from experience that have taught them the lessons.
Right. Well, and you're hitting on a couple of different things that you've been able to do through these experiences that we've been running. This was the eye opener for me, is that allowing those teams that aren't usually allowed to play because the environment was set up for them to be at odds. Now, how do you get them comfortable? We can't just get them comfortable in a project, right? That's, you don't just throw them in a project and say, we're going to do it differently. And so just be different, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. So you have to design something. So talk a little bit about what you've designed that, you know, based on some of your experiences at Lego, based on some of the experiences with these great field people and lean folks, you know, like Tito Tom comes to mind right away, like these folks that have helped you and all of us now create these experiences. How is something that used to be a speech now an actual change agent?
Wow, a lot there. So the first thing is the recognition that fundamentally the speeches don't work. The PowerPoint doesn't work. They never have. They never will. And here I give credit to Dean Reed, who did research on a guy named Fujimoto, who was part of the thought leadership with Toyota, and taught about capability building and how in any organization, one of your key capabilities is a capability building ability. So you're going to have challenges in the future you can't plan for now. You have to have how do you develop these new capabilities? But Dean came back with a very simple graphic. It's not that you create understanding and then people go do. That's backwards. And that's kind of the basis for education in Western civilization. It's the opposite. You do, you experience, and then you understand. And that shifted. Like, okay, don't show up trying to sell. Hey guys, all I'm asking for is don't give me a no. We're going to lay out a roadmap to try this and see what we learned. And at any time, if you want out, that's fine. Because then that pulls in one of those lean, respect for people, you know, pull demands. But then in the experience in the room, you layer on, okay, we're going to do things to experience it. But then you also have to, I think, amplify it if you really want change. And that's what we're talking about here, is experience and change. People have to feel it. It cannot just be a mental thing. So that's what happens in these events. You feel the frustration. You feel the hostility. You know, I've learned, I have to ask that. How many people on a team together have ever been angry with family members longer than 24 hours where you didn't speak to them because of a game? And if I have two people like that in the same group, I'll split them up, right? Because it's going to get real intentionally. We set up the role playing that way so that we're right there in that hostile, taunting, you know, back and forth, like fast. We're in that reality. And then we feel that, we see that, we all get fired because we didn't hit the target. We go learn some things, and then we come back, and now it's calm. It's clear. The visual opportunity is there to be creative. And that's what's cool for me is every time people come up with something new that I haven't seen before as a better way. But you give them that chance to have the pause and reflect moment, the visual insight, human creativity. I mean, it's a remarkable engine once you release it. But then to me, you know, the favorite takeaways are always those emotional type ahas. Including even the waste walk. And that was something we did in Denver. And maybe on the next section, I'll just give us a little plug. We'll unpack a little bit more exactly what happened in Denver. But the waste walk is normally trying to get people to feel that, okay, most studies put us between 30 and 35% material waste in traditional construction. Copper that should be more precious than gold, because at any one time, we only have 2 to 5 days in the global supply chain, we're at 20% waste. Drywall boards, 45% or 50% is not unusual. But anyway, so what we talk about these numbers, what they really mean. So here in the experience, we've built this thing and now we're going to throw away 30 to 35% of them. And so people walk by and do that. What I layered on in the experience in Denver was, what is our human waste? What is that human potential we waste? Just if we talk about it as rework. And most people now who can look at the data are like, about 30% of your labor is spent on rework, 10% of your cost. And those don't line up because sometimes the labor hides it. Like they make the mistake and then they just fix it. Or the trade partner makes a mistake and they fix it. Like it doesn't get filtered up as, you know, as real data that we can look at. But the people who are studying it, like, so again, 30% material waste, 30% human waste. So first time in Denver, in addition to throwing away the buildings, we had the people on the group that had to throw away their building go to the other side of a hall. So you had your successful team, no human waste on one side, and you saw the material waste, human waste on the other side, and it created this other tension. Like in an industry where we're challenged for talent, we're challenged for resources, we've got a 30% human waste factor to go after.
Well, and I think as we kind of bring this one home, like my big takeaway from this that you just said here of how do we get people to understand and to do something about this is by bringing the experience first. Because again, I always learned you bring awareness first, and then you teach understanding, and then they get to go do it, and then once they've done it enough, then they can teach it. That's kind of that traditional path, right? But what I'm hearing you say is, you know, like take that experience up front, let them experience and gain that understanding through the experience and have that aha awareness through that experience, as opposed to being told the awareness from someone else up front and then probably be skeptical about it, whatever. And then as they do it more, they can actually teach that mindset that, again, we're not teaching people how to do technology, how to do process. We're teaching folks how to think, right? And I think that can be tricky to do because you can't tell them that you're doing that. You just have to do it and wait for them to experience it, right?
Yes. And you hit something very important there. It's so fundamentally you're going after the emotion, but then you're also establishing the why. Like that's the how to think bit. Like it's not what to think. It's not what to do. It's not how to do it. It's that fundamental why. And those are also some of my favorite comments that people like say, thank you, Charlie, for focusing on these whys. Because often people show up in any form of work and they're given a to-do list of what to do. But they're never given that respect and that opportunity to engage and understand the why. And then to even better engage in improving on the goal because they understand that why.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And we do need to wrap this one up, but I'm just hearing this and I want to put this to Charlie and just have him wrap it this way. The other place we experience this is life, right? Life, we don't learn lessons in without experiencing it. It's the worst teacher, people will tell you, because you get the test, the experience, before you get the how to fix it. You can't go around that. So that's what we're doing. That's what you're pushing to put people through and create meaningful change. And, you know, I noticed this really early is we talk about bias and unconscious bias and how do we, you know, get people to see it. You have them experience it. to your point, you feel it. Like life, you feel what happened and then you react to it. So I'm interested, like, how are you going to keep growing this? Where are we going to see this go as we wrap it up? And what's your thoughts on it?
Well, I think I want to answer that with a couple touch points for me, because I was able to watch Nathan's angst about this idea of doing Lego at a construction engineering event, right? Like, I remember the first time, and you were almost like, are we really going to do this? Like, are people really? And I'm like, and again, I can't reason you into it. You just got to experience it, you know. But one touch point was back to it being about life. A guy named Breva teaches at MIT, wrote a book called Innovating. And he said, we all learn from experience, but we do this inhumane thing in Western education where somewhere between 9 and 11 years old, we start forcing kids to memorize from a body of knowledge and regurgitate answers onto a test. And no one ever learned anything important that way, but that's what we do all the way through to advanced education. He said, then I get these people, and what I've got to do to teach them to innovate is to play again. And so I said, well, hey, what do you do with adults who've forgotten how to play? He says, not a problem. No one really forgets. You just have to unlock, and it's usually a quick process that it's okay to play. And so that's part of what happens, is that, and how it'll continue to grow, we'll just continue to unlock that it's okay to play. And then you've seen him in person, Jeff, but Duncan Wardle has also kind of validated this. And Duncan's big on this. Like, he's even stronger than me about what's messed up with the way we try to do education. And he says, we need to smash it to bits. We don't learn from a lecture, we learn from doing. And so I think partnering with people like Duncan in events that are attracted to what Duncan does, and what's cool to me about Duncan is how much, and again, this is now teeing us up for next session, so whatever we're calling this, next bit. Then in the next bit, we can unpack more of what Duncan has said and is doing, that Nathan has already come to some of that on his own with the CPC events. We've come to that on our own with the flow state events. And that's always really cool to me when various people in different industries and different, thought domains intersect at the same point. Because that's when you know you're onto something powerful.
Yeah, you know that you're coalescing around something that's really important. I think that's been the really most interesting part for me in this process is because I have my hand and had my hand in what we're doing at the CDX and the Construction Progress Coalition and the change that's been experienced there. Then what you and I have been doing and Nathan joining us with the flow state experience, and then bringing in, people like Christina Henkai and So Built and her Lego Serious Play, different innovations. And then even, Jen and Jess with, their emotional bungee jumping experiences. These are all experiences where you're having the experience. It's unlocking a feeling, a frustration, and helping you progress through play to better outcomes, which again, also in that process of learning all the stuff we're learning about mental health, is that's how you unlock and release burnout. You don't slow people, high achievers don't slow down. You can't just say, slow down, you'll get better. You have to introduce new experiences like play that brings joy and rest and relaxation back to them. So there's, in a nutshell to me, where all of this is coalescing. And if you're listening and you have no idea what we're talking about, that's the cool part. We don't really want you to have that much because, again, it's an experience and a podcast is just a place for us to talk about it. In the future, if you guys want to know about it, reach out to the three of us. We're all so many people doing these experiences, crafting them. And like we kind of said at the beginning, my favorite thing is a wild idea and somebody asking if we can do it. I will tell you now, the answer is yes. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out, right?
Preach.
Well, listen, thanks, Charlie, for sitting down. Nathan, thank you for sitting down, for being my crewmate now. Charlie, let people know where they can go find a little bit more about you and if they want to connect with you.
Yeah, so thing I'm touching most is LinkedIn. Charlie Dunn, I'm the one that says Project Storyteller. And I think I was the first person in construction to take that. And there is a lot of hype around storytelling, but then there are some of us that it's been real for a long time. And that's been a thread in my career. And then I'm that guy, like, reach out to me. I'll respond. A lot of what I do, and I'm fortunate because of what DPR lets me do, that a lot of it, I want to give it away for free. Because the faster the industry adopts these things, there's plenty of financial opportunity for everybody if we can go after that 30 to 40% waste. And I believe we're onto some simple strategies to do that.
I think you are. I think you're right there. And I think that's the cool part of this, is that we have an opportunity to make that much change, and financially, it will actually pay for itself.
Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Charlie Dunn. To read all our news stories, learn about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.